So we have on the line Rabbi Moshe Ben Haim from Masorah.org, the great, famous Masorah.org.
Wow.
Rabbi Moshe, I really have to say how powerful and how instrumental your website has been, and not just transforming my life, but many other people who have a similar ideology. It was one of the first websites online that pushes this Torah and Halacha agenda bundled within rationalism and really questions what's considered practical Kabbalah nowadays. But tell us a little bit about yourself, Rabbi.
Well, I wouldn't say that the Kabbalah is the focus of the site, the website. I mean, I founded the site about 21 years ago for the purpose of presenting correct ideas and exposing what is false or what's baseless and doing it in a way which is very pleasing and really shows the brilliance. I mean, you take a look at scientists like Einstein, Newton, and you have stories of them, you know, working on problems in their labs for weeks on end because they were completely enthralled with God's wisdom. And that's really you know, the same creator that made the universe. And this is what the Torah speaks about all the time. You know, it correlates the Torah to nature, or it tells you God is the one in heaven and on earth. You know, why is the book of religion talking about heaven and earth? Because the primary point is that the creator that permeated nature with amazing wisdom is the same creator that made the Torah. So the Torah has to reflect deep wisdom that you can expose and be, you know, standing in awe in front of the brilliance. And that should be what Torah is. If it's not, I think the rabbis have a saying, you know, they think they say, honey and milk on your tongue. I believe it's a quote from Shlomo Melech. And Devash Becholav, Takas L'Shonech. So things that are very, very sweet should be, I don't mean under your tongue, things that are very, very, the saying is that they're not presented properly. So then they could be dissuading a person. Therefore, you want to present Torah in a way which is beautiful, that the person can really see amazing truths and be taken back and not simplified, watered down, which a lot of what Judaism has become, or is leaning towards mystical beliefs. So, you know, my intent is really that people should be, you know, awestruck by God's brilliance.
Mm-hmm. My approach explaining this whole situation or this problem that we have today in Yiddishkeit is helping people make a distinction between halakha and what's considered opinion literature, anything that falls under the realm of midrash, agarata, and in today's language, practical Kabbalah. In other words, I view the Zohar, Sefer HaBahir, and similar works just like any other medrash. Anyone who's read the Hagdama Tein Yaakov, Avraham ben Arambam, knows that we're not supposed to take all these midrashim literally and seriously. We also shouldn't say that they're all nonsense. And I acknowledge that there seems to be a few nice things and pretty things that appear in the Zohar and these mystical books, but just like most works that are misleading, they're there to in some way sugarcoat the pill. They sell you on something religiously acceptable, and then they bring in the nonsense.
Well, you have to have an approach to Torah, and that is understanding what is from God and what is from man. So that's going to be a very clear line that a person has in their mind, and what we have from God is Torah and Nevi'im and Kesuvim. So that's all through Nevuah. That means that it's communication from God. And we know those are absolute truths. And that's something which the rabbis write. Yeah, the Gemara is full of disputes. And they're shown among the Chumash. And one wise rabbi once said regarding the Zohar, if you see something in the Zohar and it makes sense, so it makes sense. It doesn't matter where it's written. But you have to realize that it's not, you know, it's not through Nevuah. It's not through prophecy. Therefore, man is not perfect, and this doesn't apply just to Zohar, it applies to anything which a human being makes. So if a person wants to know what accurate Judaism is, what authentic truths are, so you know that you have the system of listening to the rabbis, the Torah says in Devarim, in Yud Zayin, Yud Aleph, it says that, Apia Torah, Asher Yerucha, in accordance with the Torah that the rabbis teach you, you should listen to them and you shouldn't veer left or right. That means, even though a human being can make a flaw, but if he's following the system of halacha, and he tells you something, and he's a rabbi, and you ask him for a ruling, So if you ask for yourself, you have to follow it. If you ask them theoretically, so then you can shop around. You can speak to other rabbis. But the rabbis have a right, and God made the system where he gives the rabbis a right to determine what the halacha is. And you have stories in the Gemara like this where rabbis disagreed, but they had to follow the head rabbi. And I think there's one story where Tana or Amora said to another one who thought that it was, I think, Yom Kippur Rosh Hashanah that day, so he wanted to observe it, but the head rabbi said, no, come with me with your pocketbook on that day to show that you're carrying money and you're following my ruling. And I believe he did, and he went against his own opinion and followed the head rabbi and carried his money on the day that he thought was Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and the rabbi kissed him on the head. I mean, he showed that he endorsed the fact that he was following the halacha. So again, the point is that you have to know what is from God and what's from man, and also you have to know based on what makes sense. Again, Rambam has a very nice letter. He wrote the letter to the village of Marseille, and it was regarding addressing astrology. And he said that there's only one of three things that you should accept as true in life. The first thing, and not in any order of importance, but the first, he says, is what you sense. Anything that your senses tell you is true, you know it's true. That means if you see a door in a building, you know that there is a door. You could trust your eyes. God made your eyes in a way that he wants you to have belief in it. That's God's will. If you hear something, so you know that there was a sound created. So senses is the one thing that you could trust 100% that's true. The second is what your mind tells you is true. So if you figure out an equation that 2 plus 2 is 4, and your mind tells you that's true, that you could trust as being sensible. If you see something is false, you reject it. And if you see a glass window today and tomorrow you see a hole in it and it's cracked, you know that somehow a projectile went through it. You don't have to witness it, but you can use your mind. So that second category of things that you accept as true is mm-hmm. what your mind tells you. And the third mm-hmm. category is what we get from the Torah, meaning on the authority of God. And Rambam says, Maimonides says, that if anything does not fall into one of those three categories, so we don't accept it as true. So you know, your point regarding mysticism and what we accept or things in Kabbalah, if you can't wrap your mind around an idea, so you can't accept it. If I tell you, blah, you have no idea what I just said. So there's no way you can agree with that. So that's the equivalent if somebody tells you about something which your mind can't grasp. You know, the concept that Christianity has, that God is three, but he's one. You can't grasp, you know, you can't wrap your mind around it. Three is not one. The fact that God became a human being. Part of their belief, anything like that. And it doesn't matter if it's in there or people have a belief that a mezuzah protects their house. So the Shulchan Aruch says openly that if a person believes that by the merit of doing the mitzvah that God rewards a person, that's absolutely true. That's the system of the Torah, is that God rewards, reward and punishment. But the Shulchan Aruch says that if a person believes that this mezuzah itself is going to protect them physically, so then he says the mezuzah is like knives in his eyes, meaning it's damaging every single time he sees it. Because you think about it, you take a mezuzah and you light a match to it. So what's going to happen to the mezuzah? It's going to burn. Mm-hmm. So the mezuzah can't protect itself. How is it going to protect you? Just using your sensibilities, you understand it's not a protective device. And the Rambam says this too, that you lose your olam haba if you have these type of idolatrous beliefs. Well, the red bendel that people have today, they think that they wear a red string around their wrist, so it protects them from evil eye. So the Torah talks about evil eye, but it doesn't mean that anybody learns how to use their eyes in a way to hurt people.
But even the Mishnah speaks about it. It calls it Derek Amori, wearing the red bendel. But I guess people exclude that Mishnah.
Yeah, what happened is that people took the Rashi and the Chumash. So when Yaakov Avinu, they had a famine, and he had to send down his 10 sons to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, to get food, because there was a famine where they were living, Canaan. So he told them, but go through separate doors. Don't all 10 of you go through the same door, because that's going to raise suspicion. When you get down to Egypt and you enter the gates, all 10 of you coming in dressed like Israelites, Jews. Well, actually, they weren't Jews at that point. They didn't get the Torah yet. Sons of Abraham, let's call them, Abrahamites. So they dressed differently than the Egyptians, and they looked different. So that arouses suspicion. It's as if you're in Tel Aviv airport and you see 10 Arabs walking through one gate. So that, you know, one Arab is not going to alert you. So Yaakov simply did not want his sons to generate unnecessary suspicion upon themselves. Because once you do that, and people looking at you, the smallest move that could be innocent will be reinterpreted, and they'll lock you up. So that's what evil eye means. Don't do something which just causes suspicion upon yourself. But there's no powers except for God. I mean, that should be clear to a person. It's just that it's unfortunate. People have insecurities, and they're looking for these quick fixes, a red bendel. Yeah, that's going to protect me from an evil eye, which a person doesn't even know what it means. So they're making up one belief to protect them from another belief, which are both false. Unfortunate. But, you know, if you follow the Torah, you don't have this in the Torah. You don't have any stories like this in the Chumash and Navi where people are using trinkets or this is not the way it works. You pray to God, and he can hear you.
The way I learned it, in terms of being able to distinguish what's authoritative, even in the mystical world, from what's just fluff, is like you said in Perek Yud Zion, there in Parshat Shoftim, when it tells you that they shall rule from the place that I will choose, which is ultimately the Lishkat HaGazit on top of the Har Bayit. This is only regarding what you do, not what you believe. And this is why that story you mentioned, I think it was Rabbi Yehoshua, who was made to bring his purse and his stick on the day he thought was Yom Kippur, because the understanding is that you didn't have to agree with the Nasi. You had to still obey him. We don't have to believe what Chazal tell us. We're just commanded to obey their Torah. The metaphysical starts and ends with Torah. Torah Shebiktav, and that's it. And Chazal only have the authority in the practical, in how you keep Shabbat, how you keep Yom Kippur. But like the Rambam writes in Hilchot Sanhedrin, that the Sanhedrin, their power was through vote. In other words, they would vote things into existence. Now clearly, if they had the power of the metaphysical, they would just vote that Mashiach should come tomorrow, or that our enemies should be drowned in the sea. But it's only in what's called halakha lemaaseh, in what you actually do, not what you believe or anything metaphysical. And by the simple fact that the vast majority of these midrashim contradict each other, show that they cannot be relied on. And this is why I'm not big on the whole notion that things have to make sense, because there's some metaphysical concepts in Tanakh and in Torah that don't make sense, but we still embrace them.
How could you embrace something which your mind tells you is nonsensical?
Because if I agree with 90% with what appears there written in Torah Shebiktav, that's enough for me to accept the other 10% in what's called faith.
Well, keep in mind, Torah Shebiktav is not the only authority. I mean, you have Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, which is also given at Sinai. So be careful about saying that you're limiting yourself to Torah Shebiktav.
I mean, it depends. I mean, the Rambam also makes a distinction on what was actually given in Har Sinai in terms of Torah Shebaal Peh. The first paragraph of Hosbaman, he says, Bezin Agadol Sheber Yishlaim Hem Iker Torah Shebaal Peh. It's the Bezin Agadol that is the root of what we call Torah Shebaal Peh. And in Sefer Mitzvot, to the mitzvah of actually listening or believing in Torah Shebaal Peh, he ties it back to Parshat Shoftim. Now, in his Haggamah to his Parsha Mishnayot, he says that the notion of...
Well, you're saying that Bezin Hagadol, you're talking about decreeing halacha now, but not what came from Sinai. I thought you were going to tell me came from Sinai.
I'm getting to that. Okay. So he explains the notion of halacha l'moshe miSinai in his Hagdama, and he limits it to 30 laws. And even his premise for this is a little shaky, because he says the reason we know that these were actual halachas given to Moshe Rabbeinu is that there's no disagreement amongst Chazal in these areas. But then other Rabban came along and saying, wait, there are disagreements in this area, which limits what the Rambam initially considered as Halakha L'Moshe MiSinai to less than 30, because he only mentioned 30.
Halakha L'Moshe MiSinai is a completely different set of things than Torah Shebaal Peh. Are you aware of that?
Halakha L'Moshe MiSinai is part of Torah Shebaal Peh. He gives, I think, three categories of what is Torah Shebaal Peh in his Hagdama, and that's one of the things. Right?
Mishnah is Torah Shebaal Peh.
Oh, for sure. The Mishnah is for sure Torah Shebaal Peh, but ultimately, anything that came from or through the Sanhedrin is Torah Shebaal Peh, which are the statements that appear in the Mishnah. The statements in the Mishnah are basically the words of the Tanaim. I mean, men who had smicha, going all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, like it also appears in Talmud, Mishnah Torah, and Perek Avot. So whether you believe all the halachas came from Har Sinai, but like many Lubavitchers and mystics believe, or you believe that a handful of them came from Har Sinai and many of them were established by the Beis HaNagoda, by the Sanhedrin, it still falls under the mitzvah of lo tasur, of not straying from what either came from or through the Sanhedrin.
Okay, but in terms of what you said earlier, that accepting things which are, you believe that nonsense or something that you can't, fathom, I'm not sure I understand why you accept something or how you can accept something like that.
There's a faith aspect to Torah Shebichtav. In other words, there's a famous notion, like brought down by Rashi mainly, because the Rambam doesn't teach it like this, of hukim. So the notion of hukim are mitzvot that we don't understand, but we do, just out of the merit of the author of these mitzvot.
You're not citing the Rashi accurately. The Rashi was last week, the first Rashi in the Parsha, Chukas, and it says that these are the mitzvahs that the instincts and the nations of the world taunt the Jews about, meaning paraduma. So you have to read Rashi. Rashi was a real chacham. And whether he's quoting somebody or if he's wording something in a certain way, so you have to analyze him, just like you analyze the Gemara. So take a look at the Rashi. He says this mitzvah, paraduma, the red heifer, that makes somebody tamei tahar, and it makes somebody who's tahar tamei, I mean, it has the ability to have both properties, which is inherent, seems like an inherent contradiction. He says, these are the mitzvahs. It looks like these are shatnez, the law of not wearing wool and linen together. Like, what is the idea of not wearing wool and linen together? So he says, these things called chukim are things which the instincts of a person and the other nations taunt the Jews. Now, that excludes, that's also an exclusionary statement. So who does not taunt the Jews? If it's only the instincts of a person and it's the other nations that taunt the Jews, it's because the instincts of a person are not functioning intelligently. Instincts just drive towards instinctual satisfaction. So they don't have the capacity of intellect. The intellect is a different faculty completely in man. And the nations of the world who do not learn Torah also look at a law like this and say it's nonsense. But it's only them who taunts the Jews. But the Jews and the person's intellect is what Rashi excludes. Those things do not find fault with paraduma. Why? Because every mitzvah is made by God. There has to be wisdom in every single mitzvah. I mean, it says King Solomon knew the reasons for everything except for something in paraduma. But that means all the other chukim, all the other statutes, King Solomon knew the reasons for. So every mitzvah that God makes has to have beautiful wisdom. And there is great wisdom in paraduma if you look into it. And
so that understanding, I typically attribute to the Rambam in that area. I forgot where he wrote how he actually views hukim, that there mitzvot that we don't initially know the reason for, but the reason could be understood. But what's understood in the Jewish world today is that hukim are things that you're never going to know the reason for, and this is not an opinion.
Rashi says that if you do it, and then the Gemara also says if Rashi says that if you do a mitzvah and you don't understand why you're doing it, it's useless. That means the purpose of mitzvah is not the brute physical act. Waving a lulav without understanding what you're doing has no perfection for the person. It's a completely inane activity. God does not want you just to be doing this. So putting the black boxes on your arms and on your head, tefillin. You don't understand why you're doing it. There's no benefit. I mean, you have to do it. You have to still follow the Torah. But the benefit is lost because the whole benefit in mitzvah is the understanding of the concept behind the mitzvah. And tzitzis, and then kosher. And there's clues. God gives beautiful clues in the Torah about kosher. You notice that, if you ask a person why they eat kosher. So say, it's health reasons, this and that. It doesn't say that anywhere in the Torah that has to do with health. If you look at it, number one, kosher only has to do with animals. There's not one kosher law that has to do with fruits or vegetables or grain. An interesting first step. Why is that? And even in the animals, the sign of where the whether the animal's kosher or not is 90% of the time, it's in the part of the animal that makes the animal move, that gives it locomotion, meaning in the leg, in the knee, in the claw, in the paw. So if you look, why is that? If it has multiple legs, it says. If it creeps upon the ground, if it walks using its stomach, meaning a snake. If you look at it, God is giving a hint as to what it is. Now, kosher, we know, is a chok, it's a statute. But you're getting all these clues of where, and if a person, you know, spends a little time, they'll start to see a beautiful concept there. I mean, I think
understanding is between subjective truth versus universal truth. In other words, what mishpatim are typically understood as mitzvot between man and hukim are mitzvot between man and God. But any explanation for a chok, it's typically going to be in the realm of subjective truth. In other words, if you ask five different people, you'll get five different opinions, while mishpatim are typically universal truths. Like, this is clear. Don't murder. Don't bear false witness.
Hukim have stats, have reasons, and it's just that you would not have come to it on your own. But once you see the chok that God gives, then you can see the ideas. But then you would come up with your own. Without the Torah, you would say, don't kill, don't rape, don't steal. That's a mishpat. Okay,
right.
Good.
So what if a Kabbalist comes up with a very rational idea that's not sanctioned by Torah? Would you consider that objective or subjective?
If an idea, it doesn't matter if a person comes up with the idea as opposed to God. If it's true, then it's objective. It's objectively true. It's real. A subjective concept is something which has not been validated by reality. Person
but if it's not from Torah, then it's not necessarily validated by God and not necessarily true. Unlike the halachas established by the Beis and Agadol that are sanctioned by Torah because he gives them that authority.
Torah, and it's true.
But this is science versus the metaphysical. I'm talking about a metaphysical idea developed from the Zohar or from the Tanya. I stated earlier.
You can't accept it. You can't. If you cannot validate something in reality, that means all we have, again, is our senses and our intellect and the Torah. Now, like the Ram says, if something does not get validated in one of those three methods, there's no way to know that it's true. So give me an example of an idea. Let's take an example here. It's better.
There could be a metaphysical idea that makes sense. Not something that you can validate scientifically or then it ceases to be metaphysical. But reincarnation. In some way where they tie in reincarnation in a way that doesn't contradict Torah Shebik Tav. Can someone walk around thinking that they found some sort of objective truth just because it happens to make sense to him? Instead of just saying, if an idea arises today that's metaphysical, that's not sanctioned by the Torah, then it's automatically subjective.
I'm saying, if something is true, again, you validated one of those three methods, but how are you going to validate reincarnation? Reincarnation is a belief that somebody who died came back as somebody else. So how can you possibly witness the soul leaving one person and going into another? The soul is not something that your senses detect. The soul is not something that has anything to do with intelligence. To me, to witness a soul, I'm talking about. And it doesn't talk about this. It doesn't talk about this in the Torah. So how? There's no way to validate reincarnation because there's just no way to see a soul leave John and then come into the body of Jack.
Right.
It's just, and it's not.
I agree with you. I think we're saying the same things in just a different manner. Clearly, we can validate all the metaphysical ideas that appear in the five books of Moses. We accept them because God has validated to us that he's a good God and this book has civilized humanity and for many other reasons.
That's how the Torah is validated and that's how the Nevi'im are validated. Because there was an event where the Jews, 2.5 million Jews, heard intelligent voice emanating from fire. The reason why God constructed Sinai in that way, Revelation in that way, is because fire is the one element in which a human being cannot live. In cold, in wind, in sand, in water, any other element, a human being can live. But in fire, a human being can't. Now, if you hear a voice coming out of fire, now you know that the voice is supernatural. And that's what God proved, that the source of this Torah that he gave at that event is a supernatural source. It's not from this world. And it's the source, it's the thing which created the fire. It created the physical world. That's why he could make that event. And the Jews heard this, and they got the Torah, and the Torah was now validated as true. So any idea.
But you believe
Torah,
that events happen in faith, right? I mean, you can't prove that events happened. You believe that events happened in faith. I believe it happened by faith. I can't recreate Har Sinai or in any way show evidence for it, but I believe in it because.
It's the same. We accept Sinai just like we accept that Caesar existed. meaning history cannot travel through time and be accepted unanimously if it didn't happen. It would be, I'll give you a scenario. I go on the George Washington Bridge today, and I'm driving, and it's packed and everything, and it's like, you know, and I drive back to a news station, and I tell them, I was on the George Washington Bridge today, and this spaceship came down, and it gave me these tablets, and I have these tablets in my hand, and I say there were 200,000 people stuck in traffic who saw this whole event with me. So the first thing that the news company is going to ask me is, well, how come you're the only person here with this story? Now, if I cannot, you know, produce these people that I claim are part of the story, believe me, tomorrow the story is not going to be anywhere in the news. And 3,000 years later, it's not going to be a world religion accepted by all the two other major religions, which, you know, the Quran and Christianity adopts the whole history of Moses and Sinai. So this scenario is what Moses would have had to have faced if it did not happen at Sinai. He would be going around to people saying that you were on a mountain on this date, and these are the people here, and here in the book are the names of the tribes of everybody who was there, and it counts them all, names of the families, and how the count of each one. And I go to people and I tell them, you're part of this people. And you think anybody is going to look at me like, you know, if I was Moses and I'm doing this, they're going to look at me like I'm insane. They knew where they were yesterday. They were not on some mountain with 2.5 million people. So certainly these people that I tried to get to adopt this fictional story that I just fabricated, they're going to look at me like I'm crazy. They're not going to change their history and now tell their children that they were on a certain place at a certain date. They're not going to do that. And no matter who I go to, not one person is going to do it. And Moses' attempt to pass on this fabrication will die right there in the sand on that day and will not travel through time. Now, but today, what do we have? We have a unanimously agreed story that this event took place on this date to this people, certain location, and not only did the Jews accept it, but the Christians and the Muslims. Now, how do you get a story like that accepted unless it actually took place, like any history? That's why it's a proof. Mm-hmm. And Rambam uses this lesson. He says, why do we believe Moses? Not because of the plagues in Egypt, but because our eyes saw it itself, Sinai. What do you mean? How could Rambam say his eyes saw Sinai? Because he's telling you that our proof today is no less valid than with the people standing there who did see it. Because when you use principles of how do you prove history, this is a 100% airtight story. It had to have happened.
So this is an old argument made famous by Yehuda Levi, and I think Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman mentions it a lot. And I've always found a lot of flaws with the story. Now, mind you, Christianity has a similar account to around 500 people seeing Yashka go up to heaven, and in some way Christianity has still grown, and all those people were never forced to prove that that actually happened or not. And the birth of Islam, I mean, it's even more scarce, right? One person and a mountain and an angel.
Yeah, it's all fabrication.
But I'm just saying, it's not going to convince someone who doesn't already believe. Someone could have came up with that story, and I'm not questioning Sinai. I believe Sinai. My statement is that I believe it in faith, and it's not Sinai, at least in my opinion, that validates the Torah. It's the Torah argument's fault that not only validate the Torah, but validate HaKodesh Baruch Hu as a caring, loving God that even the Rambam writes in Sefer Mitzvot, that we have a mitzvah to emulate him, just like he's merciful, we are merciful.
How can you say that it's the Tariag Mitzvot that validates it? That's how do you know that God gave them?
It's because they work. In my opinion, it's always been understood. Huh?
You don't know that God gave them then. You're basing things on belief, you're saying.
For sure. I mean, I have no problem admitting that part of my religious base is based on faith. I think that because it's the Torah that has civilized humanity, because God has shown himself to be a God that if you emulate him, you could actually make this world better. I mean, mind you, pagan gods back then behaved worse than people. In this case, it's Torah that validates God and not God that validates Torah. It's because any God could claim to have created you, or any book could throw in certain stories.
You have to get a proof. You have the ability to prove things. And that's something which is part of your mind. So you have an ability to prove things, but you're allowing the most important part of your life, which is religion, to remain in the faith category. And you really should have, when you have the solid conviction, and I don't agree that you could only use Sinai to prove to people who already believe, because that didn't happen to me. When I first learned about it, I did not have any belief. It was because of the soundproof of that argument that made clear 100%.
For example, like if the mitzvot didn't work, if keeping the mitzvot not just made you but made the world a worse place, would you still accept Torah as true and the God of the Bible as your God?
Well, that's the nonsensical thing because we know what the Torah is. So we say if the Torah was not the Torah, you can't. That's not a sensible statement. You can't say if black was white, would X, Y, and Z happen? Well, black is not white, so you can't.
If you're from the Orient, if you're from China or from Japan, and you know nothing about Judaism or the Torah, and someone presented you this belief system, either based on an event that happened 3,000 years ago, or based on the validity of the mitzvot contained therein, what would be a more sensible approach to follow the God of Israel by?
Well, to say he's the God of Israel means that there's a historical event that made him the God of Israel. So you're mixing two things. You can't
about the title God of Israel. If you know nothing, if you don't have no preconceived notions of what the Bible is or what it claims to be or of all of Jewish history, but all you know is that a book appears on the scene at a time when people are basically worshiping statues and animals and behaving worse than animals, but suddenly a book appears with a system of law that civilizes humanity, that makes your life better and improves your society if you keep these
right.
statements, these mitzvot, and that book itself claims to be written by somebody.
Right.
But the simple fact that no other book throughout history has civilized the world in such a manner, it would make you think that whoever wrote this is divine. And not only is divine because he wrote a book for me, he loves me that much, and it makes me want to love him back. Isn't that a more practical approach to the whole issue?
I don't know if it's a practical issue. I would definitely agree that if something can improve people's lives, we first have to analyze what does improvement mean. If you go to somebody and you say, well, we're going to make you rich and famous and all that, so some people, a lot of people today, would think that that's an improvement. But that again has to be put to the test as to what is improvement. Meaning, what is the goal? This comes down to the question of what is the goal and purpose of a human being? And the only way you could know that is to find that out from the creator of that being. Like, if I make an object and I give it a purpose, so you can only say the purpose of the object is based on my intent because I'm the one that made it. Now, if you pick up the object not knowing me and you think the intent of this thing is something else, well, you're wrong. Okay, so you, in order to know when you talk about the benefit for a human being, that has to go back to the designer of the human being. And that's going to take us back to Sinai, because unless we have that proof, you're not going to know what the benefit is for a human being, because who determines the benefit of life? I mean, you have a million
opinions. Well, in the Tochacha, it gives us a glimpse that peace is the ultimate goal, and rain in its season and seeing your children grow old all tie into peace is really the ends in itself, with the goal that every human awaits or runs to. And that's what the Torah is there to facilitate.
Well, no, peace is not the end goal. Peace is to be a backdrop for the pursuit of wisdom of God and ultimately fear of God. But there has to be a concept of what God is, and that has to be something which is validated in one's mind and not just imagined. So that's why I'm saying Sinai is necessary for a person to see it 100% true. This way they understand that there's a supernatural being that is the cause of nature that made that event. That means he's the cause of the universe, and that this is the being that gave us the Torah. Now we have a clear path that our goal is to come closer to this being and have a longing for a relationship with him, and not just that we have a book that makes human life better, and of course better has to be questioned, that has to be validated. So that's why you can't remove God from the picture and just say, hey, this book makes life better. And this is the, not me, this is you know, the Shlomo Melech says this, that nothing compares, even mitzvahs, even other mitzvahs, nothing compares to the mitzvah of learning Torah. But the rabbis in Pirkei Avos take it one step further and say, but the goal of the learning should be that a person arrives at a fear of God. So you need, that's why I'm saying that Sinai is a necessary component, that it should really, I mean, we have the ability to prove things with our mind, so we should apply it to the most important part of our life, is what gives our soul enjoyment here, and the next world, the Olam Haba. In terms of what we have to do in life is to follow the Torah and to follow the rabbis. And we have a Shulchan Aruch, and we have a Torah. That's the Shulchan Aruch that ended, it's closed off, that is a limit. There's no new halachas being made. And we have God's word. So I don't care if a person is a Kabbalist. I don't care if he's not Jewish. People are born equal. We all have the same capacity. If a person says something and it's true, and it can be validated, it's true. And if it can't be validated, it has no meaning.
So you consider yourself more of a Litvak or a Yekke?
What do I consider myself? I guess, you know, rational. Just trying to follow the system and trying to, you know, maximizing my time in learning, teaching, you know, sharing ideas.
You know, in case somebody wants to follow in your footsteps, what school of thought do you recommend? Brisk, Amor, why you approach the things? Just because we have to give people direction or then they're going to fall into the wrong hands.
I'm trying to remember the saying that's a good answer to what you're asking. I think it was one very intelligent man who, I'm just paraphrasing, he said, if you want to be like me, don't follow me. What did he mean? He meant that the reason why he became intelligent is because he followed the wisdom. He wasn't trying to follow a person. So I would say that, you know, that's the answer to your question. You don't, if you want to, the question shouldn't be if you want to be like a certain person, but if you want to follow God's path and to really enjoy life, which is why God made people. He made a person to have the greatest enjoyment, the greatest capacity. The way a person reaches that, I mean, like to quote Rabbi Sheth, he was talking about Hillel HaZaken. So Hillel was impoverished. He was in abject poverty. But Rabbi Sheth said that if he was offered to have a life of somebody who was wealthy and this and that, or a different life, he wouldn't have taken it because people have a projection onto what happiness is. And they look at a poor person as being unhappy. But if they realize the intensity of the love that he had for wisdom, and to, you know, the people listening to this, you know, once you broadcast this, they might say, what is he talking about? Intensity of love for wisdom. That's because until you put yourself in the situation and you devote time and you minimize your work, like the rabbi saying Pirkei Avos, minimize your work, maximize your learning, and really put the years into learning Torah, you'll start seeing fruits of your labor right away. But you'll start seeing a whole world open up before your eyes. It's really amazing, the world of ideas and seeing knowledge of the Torah. And again, God made this Torah, which that means it's a tremendous amount of wisdom at every single corner, every turn, and the Gemara. And Hillel HaZaken would never have taken any other life because the enjoyment he had from learning was his life. So he didn't have as much money as somebody else. And he had to do a certain type of job that maybe is menial labor, but that to him, he didn't have these type of considerations that he had to be in a certain level of respect by other people, or that he had to have a certain amount of money in the bank. His goal was he had food, he had his water, he had his bread, he had a life where he was able to put time into learning daily, which is what his love was. And he couldn't care for other things. And that's what a person should really be aiming towards, is to try to get that enjoyment. And I think in terms of the rabbis that would help a person to get to this path, which is, you know, what I've seen is like Rambam. You read his book, Guide for the Perplexed, slowly and carefully and see what he's talking about, how he brings out beautiful ideas and use, you know, go through the Chumash, but you look at what, you know, the Ramban and the Rambam speak about and analyze Rashi and Rabbi Israel Treat is the most brilliant mind I've seen in my life. I've learned under him for over 40 years. And nobody really holds a candle to him in terms of showing a brilliance and love of learning. I mean, you have different groups that they're more focused on, let's say, Daf Yomi or covering ground as opposed to depth of thought. You mentioned Brisk. Yes, Brisk is very good in terms of learning and else, you know, to get the book or the Rav Chaim. And he goes through Rambam's book, the Mishneh Torah, and he takes different halachas and he shows the brilliance of the Rambam. And Rambam wrote a few lines and Rav Chaim wrote a few pages on the Rambam. See, these are the rabbis that really, and the Rav. I mean, these show a brilliance as opposed to what became popular today. And again, you know, Rabbi Chait talked about this. If people are learning just for it becomes another accomplishment, So not really, that's not the goal of learning, is to how many blots I have under my belt. Yeah, it's not giving you a love of the concepts. And that's not going to give you that enjoyment. It's going to become a toil. It's going to be a daily burden. That's not what God made us.
I try to package what I believe and hand it over to others. We're living in an inquisitive generation, and your website is one of the websites I recommend, Masorah.org. It's ultimately brisk.
Yeah. It's just amazing when Rabbi Chait says that the Rav's idea on something was like a brilliant idea. And I'm saying, wow. You know, because I hear what Rabbi Chait says, and he gives a shiur. You just really appreciate the depth. And, you know, I understand he put many, many hours into preparation for his shiurim. He has out now the books on Pirkei Avos, which are amazing. I recommend that to everybody to get. You know, it's on Amazon. You can look up Rabbi Chait, Chait, and look up Pirkei Avos or Ethics of the Fathers, and understand, get these books and understand how the rabbis or the Talmud, the direction for a person's perfection in life. And look at the depth of what Rabbi Chait brought out from, you know, analyzing Rambam, who commentated, who, you know, on the Pirkei Avos, as well as Rashi, and Rabbeinu Yonah, who Rabbi Chait calls a chief psychologist. And when you read, you'll see how much depth they had in understanding human nature and how a person can improve their life, and just appreciating the ideas is a joy. But the application, in terms of a person changing their life to what God really intends, that's what the rabbis sat down and they wrote Pirkei Avos about. What are the philosophical ideas you should have? The moral principles, character perfection. You know, what are the flaws in your personality and other people and how to relate with people? What values does society have that should be questioned? Again, Rabbi Chait also spoke at length about Koheles. That's also on Amazon. A very important book. What's the happiness? How does the person, you know, King Solomon was the second wisest man next to Moses. And he wrote Koheles. So he's telling you what is the right path in terms of human happiness and what is the psychological makeup of man. And so that's also, I really start with those. And that would just get the person, you know, who's like a novice or just, you know, new to learning about Torah and Judaism, a nice focus, because you can be all over the place. But if you have to have focus in terms of what are the main principles, that's why Rambam wrote the 13 principles of Judaism. And that's something which, unfortunately, people veer away. And if they had those 13 principles down, you know, a lot of the mystical ideas, you know, would be abandoned because they don't comply. So, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, we're just talking here briefly.
But I appreciate you taking the time and sharing your ideas. And I really want to redirect everyone to your website, Masorah.org. I know there's links to all those books there, also books that you've written. But we got to do this again.
Okay, my pleasure. I hope that reaches a lot of people. If they have questions, they should go to the site. But make sure they know how to spell the website, because there's no H in Masorah. It's Mesorah.org. And there's a search feature, so people can just go and search any topic that they want. There's thousands of essays. There's audio files. They can listen to classes by many, many rabbis, you know, besides myself. And the Jewish Times magazine that we've been putting out for over 20 years is 500 plus issues. Everything's free. And, you know, that's the whole purpose. The purpose is to share this wisdom with people. People really see, you know, I hope what is an undiluted, beautiful, you know, authentic Judaism.
It's kula mitzvot, and you should be mitzvah, and I know how you're studying and your teachings.
Cool. You too, Asher. Marbet Torah. We say that right before we say Eleni every day. Yagdil Torah of Yadir. Make Torah great. Okay. And all right. Be in touch.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.